The following interview is being conducted as part of the Media Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Charles B. Lane, L-A-N-E, date of birth June the 4th, 1921, at Rockford, Iowa. He presently lives in Fernandina Beach, Florida. My name is William M. Birdsong, and I will interview Mr. Lane on behalf of the Media Island Museum of History. Also attending this session is an assistant, Frank Ofelt, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Mr. Lane, could you tell us why you went into the service? I see that you went in 1943. How did you happen to go in at that time?
I was going to the University of Minnesota in 1941 when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And the next day we declared war, and the draft board was breathing down my neck, and Jimmy Stewart had a recruiting film in color at the University of Minnesota, and I went to see that, and he was in a yellow biplane with goggles on and a white scarf trailing in the breeze. And when he landed that plane and put his parachute down in the wing, I signed up right now. And because the draft board was breathing down my neck. And
so you were still in college at that time?
Yes.
How did you get chosen to be a pilot rather than some other position in the Army Air Corps?
Well, first of all, at that time, you had to have 2 years of college, which I had. And I had a chance to go in. I also played the French horn, and a buddy of mine was in a bass band out in California. In fact, he ran the band, and he asked me to come out there and be in the bass band. I would have been a buck private and sat out the war, but no, I wanted to be a flyboy. So, as I said, shortly after I saw that film, I signed up, and they had so many people signing up, they didn't call me in for about 6 months. So January 3rd, 1943, I was called up.
Was it difficult to meet the physical requirements to fly in 1943?
Yes, quite a few people didn't make it.
Were you concerned about that you might not qualify?
I never thought of that. I thought I'm in pretty good shape.
Where was your training?
San Antonio, Texas. This in January, it was pretty cold up there in Minneapolis, and they marched about 200 of us to a troop train, and we went on down to San Antonio, Texas, and that's where I started. We had 10,000 cadets down there.
What base was that?
I don't know which one it was now. I think it was Lackland.
At Lackland? And did you go through an initial basic training with people who were not going to become pilots, but just people who had come into the service?
No. This was all four cadets. If they washed out there, they would either be gunners or in some other phase of the service. But they were all in the Air Corps.
They were in the Air Corps?
Yes.
And how long was the initial training?
9 weeks in pre-flight, which included all types of tests, coordination tests, and military courtesy. From there, we went on into primary training. And they sent me to Stamford, Texas, to a primary training school, where, like Jimmy Stewart, I was in an open cockpit plane with goggles and a white scarf trailing in the breeze. I forgot there was a war on. I had the best time of my life.
What were the other guys like? Was everyone happy to be there doing that?
Oh, yes. They were quite concerned, though, because 52% of our class washed out.
At the very beginning?
In primary, which I thought was quite a percentage.
How were you living then? How did they have you quartered?
All the standard Army barracks, two-story. We could get off the base on weekends, and I joined the Drum and Bugle Corps because I got to go into town an extra night during the week.
How did you find the civilian people? Did they accept the cadets?
They were very nice to us. Couldn't have been nicer.
How many of the guys that you were with at that time would have been married or had children?
Not too many, although the cadet wives were down there. They had a cadet wives club, and then they'd see their husbands during the weekend. And I was engaged in, and my friend came down and saw me, and then we got married in basic training when I was in Enid, Oklahoma. My folks and her folks came down, and we were married in a Methodist church there. And looking back on it, like some of my best buddies were killed, I never would have done that again, because this one buddy of mine, he just had a baby girl and he was killed. It's really sad.
Was there much awareness amongst the cadets of what was actually going to happen?
I don't think so, especially in primary. I just thought I was just having a real good time, and at the end of my training, all of a sudden I'm in a B-17, and we're in training, and a few months later they're shooting at us.
Well, after that second period of training, what happened then?
Well, I went into basic training, and we were flying BT-13s, and we were taught formation flying and radio work. Then we went into twin engine. The fellows that were going into bombers went to twin engine school. The other fellows went to fighters. Three in my graduating class went to P-38s. All three were killed in training. The engines were so powerful on takeoff, if one went out, the plane would just go like that.
You have a turnover?
Yeah.
Well, after that training, were you sent overseas?
I was given my commission, given a 10-day leave, and then I had a report to Salt Lake City, Utah, where they formed crews. All the pilots and gunners and everybody were there. And we were there for about a week, and then they put us all on a troop train and sent us down to Louisiana for 3 months of phase training, where we trained as a crew. In other words, we were taught how to formation fly with a B-17, and the gunners would fire away at targets, and the bombardiers would drop bombs full of sand at targets. So we were there for 3 months.
Where were you in Louisiana?
Alexandria, Louisiana.
Alexandria. And then after that training, where did you go?
We were sent up to, we didn't get any leave, we were sent up to Grand Island, Nebraska, where they gave us a factory new B-17, which we were to fly overseas. And we flew from there up to Presque Isle, Maine. From there we went over to Goose Bay, Labrador, stayed overnight. From there we flew over the tip of Greenland to Iceland, stayed there overnight. And then we went on to Scotland. At the time we flew with a radio beam, and they warned us when we were leaving Iceland that the Germans can bend those beams, and so you would get off course. And one crew, the Germans bent the beam, and this crew with a brand new B-17 flew into Norway, and the Germans greeted him and had a brand new B-17. So they told us to depend on our other instruments. So anyway, we got into Scotland, and they sent us by train to our base.
And where was your first base?
Bury St. Edmunds, which was 90 miles northeast of London, about 30 miles east of Cambridge.
Had you ever been to Europe before?
No.
most of the people in your group, have they ever been overseas?
No. I was 22 years old. Most of the guys are younger than me.
And how were you quartered in England?
The Quonset hut, I showed you a picture of it. And they had 12 officers in a Quonset hut. In other words, officers from three crews. Then the enlisted men were in another Quonset hut. And all our bathroom facilities were in another Quonset hut. It was kind of rough.
How did most of the people adjust to that? Did anyone have any real problems?
No, not really. We were all worried about how we were going to get through our missions.
Well, in close living quarters like that, did everyone get along fairly well with each other?
Yes, they did. We were issued 45s, and the guys were always having problems with their 45s. They were cleaning them or something. One guy shot his finger off, and another one shot a hole through the roof. Things like that would happen.
Did any other strange things happen in the Quonset huts?
Not that I know of. It was kind of cold there. We had a stove that is about that wide in the middle of the hut, and you didn't get warm unless you got right next to the stove.
How was the food?
It was all right. It was all frozen. And like breakfast, if you wanted toast, you put some slice of bread on your fork and held it up to the heater, things like that. But we had pretty good food compared to the guys in the infantry.
Were you able to get off the base very much?
Not every weekend or anything like that. It depended on our missions. But once in a while, we got passes into London, 3-day pass. And I went through a few air raids there. I didn't go to the bomb shelters because I thought, they can't kill me over Berlin, they can't kill me here. But boy, one night, one of those buzz bombs came over and cut out right over us. The next morning I went down and all the shopkeepers are sweeping up glass from their stores.
Well, did you meet many of the people in England, the English
people?
Yes.
I did. Yeah. They were very nice to us.
I know sometimes we see that the people even end up marrying people. Did any of the people in your group?
Not that I know of.
Involved with
English? But I understand quite a few got married, but I had just been married before I left, and I saw they had dances and everything. They'd line up girls, they'd send army trucks out, and girls in different parts of the service from the British Army, they'd bring them in, and I never went to any of the dances.
How often would the missions actually occur?
Well, they kept us busy. We were on practice missions an awful lot. After the practice missions, when we became veterans, they'd have us going up with the new crews, formation flying and all that. They kept us busy all the time. So when we weren't flying missions, we were on practice missions. They really kept us busy.
Did you fly almost every day?
No. I'd say maybe every other day, something like that. The weather was very bad there. We'd go through 10,000 feet of overcast.
What would a typical mission be like? Would you be accompanied by fighters at the very beginning and then they turn back, or what was it like?
No, we never really saw the fighters until we got way into France or Germany. First of all, we had to fly across the channel. No, there was no fighter cover there. But in the early stages, the fighters would stay with us about maybe a half hour, and then they had to turn back, and a new group would come in. And that's, the Germans were pretty sharp. If the other fighters didn't come right away, they came out of the clouds. We really had a lot of problems. The P-51s were the ones that saved the day because they could go all the way to Berlin with us. And when I first came over there, they couldn't go that far. But the later P-51s could go all the way in.
What was the flight like itself? The plane was cold, wasn't it?
Yes, below zero. They gave us heated flying suits for a while, but we found out they shorted out, so we just had real heavy flight gear. And it would get up to 25 to 30 below up there, depending on the altitude you're at. We flew from 20,000 up to 30,000 feet. I'd say the average was about 25.
So most of the mission would have been on oxygen then?
From 10,000 feet up, we had oxygen on it.
Was that ever a problem?
Well, over Munich, we really got shot up over Munich, and our central oxygen system got shot out. So we had emergency bottles, big bottles. So try flying a plane with a big oxygen bottle in your lap.
So the rest of the crew have the walkabout bottles where they could...
Yes. Everybody had emergency bottles.
Well, did you fly primarily in the daytime for the missions?
We assembled in the early morning. For instance, on the D-Day landings, they got us up for breakfast at 10:30 at night. We went into briefing, and it takes quite a while to assemble. We send one group up to form a wing, and that's 54 planes in formation. Then 3 minutes later is another wing, and you get 2,000 bombers going in. There isn't much left as a target.
You want to take a pause? Want to pause? We've talked for like 15 minutes. Do you want to pause?